Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Saturday, February 25th, 2012. This is episode 851. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 free postage. Visit Stamps.com and use the promo code TechGuy. Hello, everybody. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk about computers and the internet and cell phones and camcorders and MP3 players and home theater and all that jazz. The things in our lives that confuse us no end. All those things with a chip in it. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, if you want a little hand-holding on the information superhighway, they don't call it that anymore, do they? 8888-ASK-LEO's a phone number. That's what we used to call it, the information. Well, nobody really who was into technology called it that. That's what the media called it, the infobon. I guess because the idea was that just as the federal government had built the interstate highway system in the 50s, that linked the world, that they, in the same way, in the 80s and 90s, were building the information superhighways, interstate, actually international highway system. It was in 1989, actually, that a researcher, I think, first used the word information superhighway. Bill Johnston from LBL was called to Washington for a U.S. Senate hearing. That's Lawrence Berkeley Labs to the uninitiated. It's over here on the other side of the bay from me. And during the first live computer demonstration, this is 1989, not even that long ago, ever conducted before a Senate hearing, they exhibited the possibilities of a high-speed transcontinental your computer network. Wait a minute, 1989? Just 23 years ago. The researchers plugged in a computer. This is from an article at the Lawrence Berkeley Labs site, lbl.gov, about this momentous occasion. The researchers plugged in a computer and displayed data processed, analyzed, and assembled into animated scientific movies by devices and researchers distributed thousands of miles apart. We sure take this for granted now, don't we? And this was a big deal. They demonstrated how equipment such as a magnetic resonance imaging unit, MRI, supercomputers, data storage devices, and computer workstations could be temporarily bridged together. I think it ended up being pretty permanent. Linking individuals and resources in ways never before possible. Al Gore was a senator at this 1989. He chaired the 1989 hearing. And, you know, Al Gore's dad was one of the important members of Congress who built the interstate highway system. And I think Al Gore, this is where that quote, he never said, I invented the internet, but this is where that quote came from, is that he felt, as his dad had felt when he built the interstate highway system, that the government had to support the development of an interstate information system. 4 years later, when he was vice president, and he flew with Bill Clinton to Silicon Valley and met in 1993 with Silicon Graphics, briefed on the status of the emerging information superhighway. Well, I think we should remember those days. They aren't so long ago that this vision, which seemed like pure science fiction, was conceived. This article, which was written in 1993, says, today, a fused infrastructure of more than 11,000 networks known as the Internet, or just, quote, the net, joins upwards of 10 million people around the world. There's more people on Twitter right now in the state of California, probably. 10 million people around the world. The estimates now are upwards of 1.5 billion people on the Internet. Out of a population, total world population, what is it, 7 billion now, 6 or 7 billion? 1.5 billion people. And that's just 20 years later. Kind of an amazing revolution. And that's really in the last few years. You know, I started doing computer talk the year before this article came out. And when we were doing that, it was just really Windows 3.1 and DOS 5, and it wasn't really about the Internet because nobody really had access to it. You know, if you went online in the early 90s, you were using CompuServe. Remember that? Or Genie. Was AOL even around by then? Maybe it was the beginnings of AOL. This stuff was the early Prodigy, Delphi. Yeah, you remember those. That was getting online. Or maybe you were lucky and you were using a bulletin board system. I ran a computer bulletin board system in San Francisco for Macintosh users in 1985 and 86. That was how you got online. And the idea of communicating between bulletin boards was very new and different and difficult. The kind of bulletin board system I was running was based on FIDO, and it did allow us, using a technology that was really homegrown called ECHONET, to post a message on one bulletin board and have it go to other bulletin boards across the country. Man, we thought that was cool. This is before email was widespread. In those days, you know, if you had email, you had a corporate system like MCI Mail, and you could only email somebody who had an MCI Mail account, or maybe you were on CompuServe, but then you could only email somebody who was on CompuServe. In fact, do you remember your, for you old-timers, just I'm curious, do you remember your CompuServe? You didn't have a name on CompuServe, you had a number. 75106,3135. That was me. You didn't have that was and that was your email address. 75106. No wonder I remember it. .3135. Do you remember that? Bill in Michigan was 71664-3132. That's we've come a long way in 20 years. And it's really interesting to see. And of course now what we spend a lot of time talking about, and the reason I bring this up is this week we've been talking a lot about privacy online. And the reason I bring this up is to remind everybody this stuff is really new. We're just in the very infancy of this stuff. And I think we act as if, well, everybody ought to know how to do it and what people want and how to protect privacy. And you know, people are upset about Google. They're upset about Path. They're upset about Twitter sharing their contact address books and that kind of thing. They're upset about Google getting around Apple's built-in privacy protections on iOS. And yeah, of course, we should be upset and we should pay. I'm not saying we shouldn't pay attention to these things, but I think that it's also a little bit understandable because it's so new, really. You know, it was only 20 years ago that we were even considering the idea that perhaps individuals could be linked one to another across something called the Internet. There might be as many as 10 million people online. So nobody was thinking about security. Nobody was thinking, in fact, email, you couldn't email somebody if they weren't on your system. Viruses weren't real because we didn't have that kind of interconnectivity. People couldn't get into your system because you weren't online. You weren't connected to anything that anybody could get to. Privacy, how would somebody get your contact list if you weren't connected to them? You couldn't. And so in 20 years, not only have we created this infrastructure that connects full-time our computers one to another, full-time all over the world to billions of other people, but now we carry in our pockets something that is full-time connected. Not only full-time connected, has a GPS in it so it knows exactly where we are and will broadcast this to anybody. It has all of our personal information like our address book in here. And it's always connected. So We have a lot to learn. We have a lot to think about. I think it's not surprising that mistakes are going to get made, that Google and Path and others are going to make these kinds of mistakes. The key is how we respond once we learn about them and what we do going forward. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello? Hello?
Oh, you have to hear it in program two. I'm sorry. All right, we're good.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number if you've got a question, a comment, suggestion, if you'd like to talk about the information superhighway. People get, you know, all head up about companies like Path and Google, companies to which we give permission, by the way, to access our private information. And they forget sometimes, I think, that there's a lot of people who aren't asking permission, who are tracking you, including government, law enforcement, your internet service provider, all of whom know a lot more about you than Google. Congressman Lamar Smith has a new bill. He seems to be one of the guys who's the most interested in, using the internet to spy on us, and yet is also one of the guys who's the most angry about privacy invasions. He was the author of SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, which, you know, he kind of got slapped around a little bit. We managed to nip that in the bud. So he's got a new bill, H.R. 1981. He calls it Protecting Children from Internet Pornographers Act of 2011. It's a good title because nobody's going to say no to that. I mean, of course, we all want to protect children from internet pornographers, I guess. Others might be calling it the Internet Surveillance Act. It is a grave threat to your privacy online, much more so than anything Google or Path ever did. Here's some of it. This is from Section 4. A commercial provider of an electronic communication service, that's your internet service provider, shall retain for a period of at least 1 year a log of the temporarily signed network addresses the provider assigns to a subscriber that enables the identification of the customer. So they keep that online. So they know exactly who you are on the internet for at least a year. Requires a provider of electronic communication service, remote computing service, to retain for at least 18 months those addresses, unless that address is transmitted by radio communication. I don't know what that means. And, of course, it bars any cause of action against a provider for retaining those records. In other words, it indemnifies against lawsuit. So what are they going to do after all that? Well, they're going to store all your IP addresses along with any highly sensitive personal information such as credit card data for at least 12 months. And then not only law enforcement can get that information, but any civil litigant in a private lawsuit. So let's say you go online on your Twitter account and you say, you know, I just got terrible service from my grocery store. They can sue you, and then they can go to your internet service provider and say, you got to tell us everything this person did over the last 12 months. A divorce lawyer looking for dirty laundry. Black hat hackers will, of course, attempt to get these databases for identity theft. I recommend you visit the Electronic Frontier Foundation and read up on this one. This is great. H.R. 1861. I'm sorry. That's just the year it feels like. It's H.R. 1981. I'm sorry. Mandatory data retention proposal that they tie to internet pornography for reasons I don't, you know, it's not. That actually should be a giveaway. That's almost a smoking gun because it has nothing to do with that. It's really the motion picture and the record industry saying, hey, we want a way to track people down. Just not through law enforcement, but just through lawsuit. It threatens your right to browse the web privately, to speak and read anonymously when you're online, creates vast new databases of information about you that your internet service provider, who knows more about you than anybody, by the way, on your online, he knows everything about your online behavior, would be required to keep. And it's not just law enforcement. It would be available to anybody who decides to go after you for any reason at all in court. The House Judiciary Committee has voted to approve the bill. Could be on the House floor very soon. H, remember this one. There's another one. And they just will keep coming, believe me, H.R. 1981. So don't get distracted by the circus of privacy. Certainly we ought to worry about it. I'm not saying we shouldn't, about privacy infringements by companies. But it's not just companies. And in fact, there's people out there who know a whole lot more about you than any given company. And the government would love, the government and the music industry and the television industry and the motion picture industry would love to make sure that information is preserved so they can sue you. Frank, or, you know, chase you. Franco in Chicago, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Franco.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I'm a huge fan. I watch Twit every day, and I've been watching you since Tech TV days.
Thank you.
I had a quick question about the iPhone data plans at AT&T. I wonder if you had heard about the small claims victory yesterday. Somebody had sued AT&T in small claims court and won $850. And I was wondering if you thought this was something that was going to kind of reach a pinnacle right now, because I know that they have some stuff in their contract to suggest that there can't be a larger lawsuit.
Well, here's the deal. It was, as you say, small claims. An iPhone user said, AT&T said I had unlimited data, and now they're throttling me. The judge said it was unfair for AT&T to slow down his service. You know, AT&T's been doing that. You may have received, many of us have received text messages from AT&T saying, hey, you're the top 5% of users. Probably anybody who listens to me online is in that group. And we're going to slow you down. The customer that won his case in court said his speeds were throttled when he used about 1.5 to 2 gigabytes of data in 1 month, even though he had an unlimited plan, so-called unlimited plan. AT&T is appealing because, of course, they don't like this idea. But it isn't exactly, it's not exactly, if I were AT&T, I'd just shut up and pay the money, because what you don't want is a higher court ruling. This is just small claims court.
Right.
It's not, it doesn't have, you know, it doesn't set a precedent. It doesn't, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't believe it has any, you know, it's not exactly like the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals or the U.S. Supreme Court saying this. It's just some judge.
Right. But I was wondering if this would start kind of like a rush of people doing similar things, you know, and if that would have any effect.
I think it's a great idea. That's a great idea. So this was in Ventura County in Simi Valley. Pro tem judge, who's temporary judge, Russell Nadell, said it wasn't fair. This is in Simi Valley on Friday. The plaintiff was an unemployed truck driver and student, and he went to small claims court against AT&T. He's a hero, I'll tell you, for the modern age. But I don't know how much I don't.
Twit Army.
yeah. No, Ken. I just don't know how much weight that carries going forward. You know, it's small claims court. But imagine how. I think AT&T's fear is that this will become a big story. That's why they should just shut up, pay the $850, and walk away. Because if it becomes a big story, I think you're right. I think others might do it, and I think everybody listening now, should think about that. It's very interesting.
And the throttling is pretty severe. I've had every iPhone since the first, and the speeds that I'm getting right now, because I got throttled 2 days ago, feel like iPhone 1.
Yeah. Horrible, isn't it? Horrible. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And LA Law continues. We have somebody in the chat room. Hey, Scott Wilkinson. Scott Wilkinson is here, our home theater guru from Home Theater
Leo.
Magazine. Hey, Scotty. So, we have. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm asking anybody in our chat room who is a Perry Mason to weigh in. And the question is, does a ruling by a small claims court have any precedent setting value? And the attorneys in the chat room said only in that court, so it's not widespread. They said that AT&T is probably appealing it, and only a defendant can appeal in small claims court. They're probably appealing it because they want to make it feel like it's going to be very expensive for anybody who wants to go after them. They want to say, look, we are going to defend against these. So don't think you can just walk into your small claims court and come
out
with
$850.
Right,
bucks.
Right. And that does make sense. There is a risk, of course, if they lose in a higher court, a court where a precedent could be set. I would guess that that would be a risk. So they must feel fairly confident that they'll win this one. It's very interesting. But at least they want to send the message, hey, don't think you can get $850 at us without significant legal expense.
Don't mess with us.
Don't
man.
Mess with us, Woody. We're the phone company. You know. So, Scott, tomorrow's the big day for people of your kind.
It is. It's the Oscars.
It's the Oscars.
Can't wait.
It's nice of the entertainment industry to give us, in the worst months of the year, January and February, the Super Bowl and the Oscars, something to do to keep our minds off the snow and the cold and the wind and the rain. And I'm looking for. I love the Oscars.
I do too.
Yeah, I can't wait. Even though it's gotten bloated and it's always been, you know, overlong and.
But I'm so happy that Billy Crystal is hosting again. I just always thought he was the best host.
Yeah, I interviewed. In fact, you know, I got to find that audio and we could put it on the show. I should have asked somebody to do that. I interviewed Steve Martin on Wednesday, and I asked him. I said, "Do you miss, you know, doing the Oscars? Do you, you know, because remember he and Alec Baldwin did it a few years ago. It was just fantastic.
That was hilarious. Yeah,
I said, do you see, you know, you see Billy doing it, and you feel like, oh golly, you know, I wish I were there. He said, no, for me, it's just like the Super Bowl. Sometimes you're in it, sometimes you're not. And the years you're not in it, you just watch.
Right.
All right. Okay.
All right.
So, but anyway, and we will get that interview. I wasn't thinking. I'll get the audio of that interview for you because it was fun.
We spent an hour with him.
Yeah, he's just.
Oh, yeah.
He has a new Twitter book, and proceeds from which go to his charity. So that's kind of neat. And it's just.
Oh, yeah. And he's been tweeting about it, too. It's been great.
Oh, he's so funny.
He's one of the funniest tweeters I know.
I have to say he's not in the nominee list this year because the movie he did make this year, Big Year, I liked it, but it wasn't a major motion picture. It was, you know, it was fun. Jack Black, it was fun.
Yeah.
So today you have a tale of two movies for us.
I do. I have a tale of two 3D movies, actually, one of which supports your position on 3D entirely, and that is Star Wars in 3D.
Star Wars in 3D. Yeah, you know, they made, they're trying to capitalize on this 3D fad while it lasts. So they redid Star Wars Episode 1, the one with Jar Jar.
Yes.
say no more. And the Titanic have been both re-released as 3D movies.
Well, Titanic's not out yet.
So it will be. Yeah.
It will be very soon. Now, James Cameron obviously is doing Titanic, right. And he is so into 3D that I expect it probably will be pretty good. But I also expected Star Wars 3D conversion to be good.
Sure, George Lucas is a perfectionist. He's not going to...
Absolutely. Yeah. It was horrible.
Oh, really?
It was awful.
What was so bad about it?
Well, there was basically no 3D at all. I mean, for example, the opening scene where you see Star Wars and the big opening music and it recedes into the background.
Yeah, that should be 3D.
Of course it should. And the backstory text that recedes into the background, none of it.
So Mr. Eustace says no good, sir.
And as I wrote in my piece about it on my website, you know, no amount of 3D is going to make Jar Jar any less annoying.
No, we want the Jar Jar free edit.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. No, yeah. What 3D there was wasn't even very much. It was very, very subtle. Now, that's one approach to take.
Yeah, but if you're going to make me wear glasses and it's going to be dim and the whole thing, and smudges, I at least want to get something for it.
Exactly, and you get nothing.
I want to have to dodge things flying out of me. And Star Wars should lend itself to that. I mean, those fighters, the TIE fighters coming at you.
Of course.
Giant lasers or whatever those things are. Yeah, it should come out.
There
was
virtually nothing in there at all. And to tell you the truth, I've seen that movie a couple of times now. So I spent most of the movie putting my glasses on and off, you know, just to see what was going on.
Yeah.
And it was really, really disappointing.
Made about $38 million in the first two weekends.
Yeah, well.
I'm sure that paid for the conversion, but it's not a... I bet you they were hoping for $100 million, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, the theater I went to had two theaters scheduled reserved to see it, and one of them said, when I went to buy my ticket, said, you know, this showing is canceled.
Now, there's too few people to turn on the lights.
Exactly. No, and the theater I was in, you know, and I admit I was, I don't know, about a week after it opened. But the theater I was in, there weren't that many people.
Yeah.
So,
but that doesn't mean anything. It just means it's not a good conversion, or people didn't want to see that movie again, or whatever. I mean, that's
now Star Wars Episode One. Most people think it is probably the worst of the Star Wars movies of the six movies.
Yeah, right? Are they going to make all six 3D?
Well, they're doing it one at a time, I'm sure. So this was the first one, and I imagine they'll go in episode order rather than release order.
Right.
Right. So they'll go episode one, two,
chronological
three,
order. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, the other movie that I want to point out is a 3D movie that is among the best, has the best 3D I've ever seen.
Oh,
I've seen a lot of 3D now, but this one is not nearly as mass market, but it is up for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. It's called Pina, P-I-N-A. It's a documentary about a modern dance choreographer by the name of Pina Bausch, who lived in Germany. She died in 2009. And the director, Wim Wenders, who did Buena Vista Social Club, decided he wanted to document Pina Bausch's modern dance work. She had been a choreographer for 35 years in a town called Wuppertal, Germany. And so he saw a piece of hers, and he really wanted to document this on film, but he wasn't sure how to do it because modern dance is so spatial.
Right.
So he for a long time wondered how to do it. Finally, he went and he saw the U2 3D concert movie. I don't know if you've seen that one or not.
I've heard about it. No, I missed it, unfortunately.
It's actually pretty good.
Yeah, I'm a fan of U2.
Yeah, well, this is actually a very good 3D movie. It's used in a lot of demos at CES and places like that where they're showing 3D. They'll show the U2 movie. Anyway, Wim Wenders saw this movie, and he said, that's how we'll do it. We'll shoot it in 3D. And so he put cameras in the middle of the dancers as they're doing these pieces and had to choreograph the cameras so they didn't bump into the dancers.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. So you're right there on the stage with them.
You're in the middle of the action.
Yeah, and that might be kind of neat.
The depth that you see is continuous. It's not like a cardboard cutout situation like you sometimes see.
Yeah.
It's really good. It's really good. So, you know, a lot of people don't like modern dance particularly. They just find it weird, and it can be kind of disturbing. But if you can get past all of that, I would go see this movie just for the 3D alone because it's really good.
Scott Wilkinson, online editor for Home Theater Magazine, hometheater.com, and his Home Theater Geeks podcast is on our Twit network, twit.tv. Thank you, Scott. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
I'm so nervous. I haven't been out there in 3 years. Give me some advice.
Light him up, Bill.
Is that for? That's from the last time he was on.
From 2004.
2004. Billy Crystal. He's going to be back hosting the Academy Awards Monday. No, tomorrow night. Tomorrow night. I wanted to mention that Scott Wilkinson will be back Monday at 1:30. He does a podcast for us called Home Theater Geeks, and Scott will be. I am very excited. He'll be spending an hour with Alan Parsons. 1:30 Monday for the Home Theater Geeks podcast at twit.tv. You can tune in and watch it live or download it after the fact at twit.tv. Alan Parsons, you may recognize that name. He was a studio engineer for the last two Beatles albums. Then he did Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. Then he did the Alan Parsons Project, and he's still a record producer, very active, an expert on the state of the art in recording, and he's been doing it since the 70s, so he's really been around. That should be a lot of fun. Alan Parsons, 1:30 Monday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern on twit.tv. Ronald, Los Angeles, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Ronald. That's his 100th show, by the way. Hi, Ronald.
Huh?
Hey.
Anyway, I'm calling because you've been helpful in the past, and I'm one of those protective fathers of a minor daughter. And I discovered her Twitter account. After discovering it, it became protected. Then I trolled to find her new username and came up with the username. But the fact that it's protected
means she doesn't want you to read it, Dad. Right?
Well, that's obvious, of course.
Yeah. You can't access it. There's no way to access it. If she doesn't give you her password, that's it. Twitter will not give you that information.
Well, let me ask you this. Is the IP, is there any way of discovering her IP?
You mean where she's tweeting from?
Correct.
She's not tweeting from your house?
No, because she doesn't live in my household.
Yeah, no. You can't, Twitter, you can get a court order.
Okay.
That's the only way. Is she under 13?
No, she isn't. She's 15 years old.
Yeah. No, you don't have access to her Twitter account. You don't have access to her IP address. You can, law enforcement can get the IP address of a Twitter account with a subpoena. I've actually had that done when my daughter was getting death threats. But that was because she was getting death threats. I don't think that a father could just say, hey, what the hell is my daughter's IP address? I don't think you're going to get that from anybody.
No, but it would have to come from a court order.
It would
order.
Have to be a criminal action, yeah. Or a court order. I guess a judge could order it. No, absolutely. If there's a custody battle or, you know, some sort of issue, a judge could order it. She's a minor, so a judge could order it. But that's and then Twitter would only give you her IP address. Twitter, I do not think, would give you access to a protected account. Maybe they would. You know, in general, most companies that do internet services like mail or tweets or Facebook and so forth are very responsive to court orders, but completely unresponsive to anything short of that. In other words, you have to get a judge or law enforcement has to get a judge to issue an order. When we were having trouble with Twitter, I appealed directly to Twitter's founder, who is an acquaintance, and he refused. And so we then went to a local law enforcement. They agreed with us that it was there are certain standards that a threat has to rise to before they take action. They agreed it had risen to that standard. So they subpoenaed Twitter, and what Twitter gave them was one thing only, the IP address. It was a public account, so we knew what the messages were, obviously. Then the law enforcement, and they were very helpful, and I'm very grateful to them, went to, you know, once you have an IP address, that gives you geographic information. It tells you who the internet service provider is. They then went to that jurisdiction, subpoenaed the internet service provider for, and this is what we were talking about earlier, for the name of the person who is using that IP address at the time of that tweet, the name and address. They got that information, and then local law enforcement went to their home. And as it turned out, it was another minor, and he wasn't really aware of what he was, you know, what that threat that he had made meant. He got in a lot of trouble with his dad, but there was no legal action, no pursuit of that. So that's the process that you would have to undergo. Now, I would say if, you know, this is something for parents. Look, I'm a parent of a teen. I understand. I really understand. And the temptation, the need sometimes to spy on your teen is great. And when I was a kid, that meant going into your kid's room and finding their diary and breaking the lock and reading it. Nowadays, we have so much information online that we would love to see. Some parents do require that their kids get, you know, if you want to be online in my house and with my internet, then you have to give me the passwords to your accounts or I'm not going to let you do it. I think it's important, and this is personal, and this isn't, it's all, obviously you're a parent, you get to decide what to do. But it's my opinion, and the way I've acted with my kids is that it is their, kids need somewhere private. They need a diary. They need somewhere to communicate with their friends. They don't want to be spied upon by their parents all the time, and I think that that's kind of a chilling effect. I think if your kid is in trouble, if you feel like your kid might be using drugs or getting in trouble somehow, that changes the landscape. But if your kid seems to be normal, I think just the idea of spying on them just to make sure, I'm not fond of that. And when my kids have been in trouble, I have, in fact, asked them or used technical means to keep an eye on what they're up to online. And certainly if you have a very young child online, you want to make sure they understand the risks of being online and have a reasonable way to handle these things. But I'm not of the opinion that a parent certainly a parent has the right to. I'm not saying you don't have the right to, but I think that it's important for teens to have some privacy too. So, but that's a parenting decision, not a technical decision. From a pure technical point of view, unless the kid offers that information up to you, you have no way of getting it. You can't go to Facebook and say, my kid is 16, so give me his password. Won't work. You have to go to a court to do that. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, and it's time to talk about computers, the internet, cell phones and camcorders, home theater and all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number, 888-827-5536, toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. Outside the U.S., you can Skype in, toll-free. Just use Skype out and call a toll-free number anywhere in the U.S., and that's apparently, I'm told, that's free. Scott is in Irvine. Thanks for your patience, Scott. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Scott.
So I'm one of those dads that have taken hours and hours of home movies over the years, and they're currently sitting on one of my laptops on the hard drive and on a backup.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, we hardly ever watch them.
Yes. But you'll be glad you have them when you're dead.
Yeah, exactly.
I often wonder, you know, we all shoot a lot of video. We all shoot a lot of pictures. And I just wonder who's going to look at those after we're gone. Because, well, I guess our ancestors will be the ancestors. What do you call our descendants will perhaps be interested for historical reasons. But there's so much of it. Yeah, it's a time. Yeah. I think we're shooting far too much, to be honest with you. Nobody's going to have time to watch it all.
That's probably true.
But I am so glad that I have video. I have video of my child reading, my son reading for the first time. And that is worth more than gold to me. So I understand. Right. It's, you know, I'm glad I recorded a few things. I'm very glad I recorded. So you want to make those visible. You know, when I was a kid, we would do slideshows. You know, everything was on slides. And we'd pull out the Kodak slide projector. And it was a big production, you know. And then you'd. For 3 hours, you'd sit and watch slides. We'd do that every few years. That was fun. Wouldn't it be fun now on your big screen TV? You could do all of that. So there are a couple of things to do. You know, I'm sitting right now in front of a Samsung, one of the brand new Samsung TVs that we were reviewing for our review show Before You Buy. It's the D8000. Nice TV, but it has, as many new TVs do, internet access. It's either got Ethernet or Wi-Fi built into it, and something called DLNA. And DLNA is very cool. It means that you can, from your Windows computer or your smartphone, send the data wirelessly, as long as you're on the same network, to the television. So if you've got a Windows computer, you can use DLNA to just take what's your TV and your computer hook up. You know, you browse through the computer to find the TV. You browse through the TV to find the computer. You connect them just kind of like, it's like Bluetooth, except it's over the Wi-Fi. And now you can watch those videos. If you have a Mac, you have to do Apple's version of DLNA, which is called AirPlay. Same idea. So you can, from an iPhone, a Macintosh, or a iPad. Now, in this case, you won't be playing it to your television set. You'll be playing it to your Apple TV device, which is connected to the television. And then you can do that. Are you Mac or Windows?
Right now, I'm Windows. My PCs are older. And to be honest, if moving to a Mac made this, you know, a lot better, I'm potentially willing to make that investment.
It's the same. It's very similar. In the Windows world, sometimes they make these things called media extenders. Western Digital makes something called WD Live. That's a hard drive that you could either put the content on, or Seagate's got something similar that it sees the network and can play stuff from the network. Really, what you have to have is either a television that has internet access, or Wi-Fi rather, or a device hooked up to it that has Wi-Fi or internet access. And then they're all connected on the same. Actually, internet access isn't accurate in this case. It's LAN access to your home network. And then the computer or the device can play it. There's other things you could do. Many TVs have SD card slots. This TV has three USB connectors, so you could put stuff on a thumb drive and just leave it plugged into the TV. And then any time you felt like watching it, you could do that. Or you could plug in a hard drive to your TV and watch it that way.
So about a year ago, my TV it's relatively new, but it doesn't have DLNA. So I think I got one of these Western Digital devices.
There you go.
And it wouldn't recognize my .AVI file.
Well, then that's another issue. And that's going to come up also with an Apple TV and a lot of these devices, is most of them are not smart enough to play everything that's out there.
Right.
And so you will then have to transcode, that is, convert the AVI into something that that device can see. So you'll have to look in the manual or look online to find out what kinds of... This is where it really is a tower of Babel. There are dozens of ways of storing video digitally. We call these codecs, or compression decompression software. And there are so many different codecs. And then the codecs have wrappers. AVI isn't a codec. It's a wrapper. QuickTime's MOV is a wrapper. Matryoshka is a wrapper with a codec inside of it. So your device has to handle the wrapper. It has to know what an AVI is. And then what's inside that wrapping... It also has to understand the codec there, if it's H.264 or if it's, Cinepak, or, gosh, there's a whole bunch of those. It gets ugly. But the good news is, if you've already got it on a hard drive, you can transcode it or translate it into a format that is preferred by that device.
So my last question, if you have time, is can you recommend a conversion video software? The reason why I'm in AVI is because when I play it back, to me it looks best. But the files are huge. An hour of video is three.
Well,
or four
it's not really AVI. It's whatever that is stored within that AVI, which could be MPEG-2, MPEG. It could be MPEG. It could be MPEG-2. It could be H.264. There's a whole lot of different formats. So that whatever that is. And you know what? It's not the compression technology entirely. It's also, you said it was big. That's why it looks good. There's a direct trade-off between file size and quality of the video. So all of these are factors. I think you should certainly start with a program that's free called Handbrake.
Handbrake?
Handbrake. It's designed for taking DVDs and converting them to a file format that device can play, but it can take other files as well. And it's free. Handbrake, BRAKE.FR. That's a place to start, but there are lots of commercial programs that will do this as well. There's a lot of good choices. Your first deal is to figure out what the heck I need. And if you want to stick with that Western Digital, then you should read the manual on that and find out what's best on that, or just Google it. What's the best video format for that?
Right.
But what you really need, so in order to get the contents of a hard drive onto a big screen TV, you need some way to connect that TV to your local area network, whether it's built into the TV or it's an external device like a Boxy Box, a Logitech TV, a WD Live. I mean, there's dozens of them, right? Maybe a USB port on the TV lets it connect up the media directly. And then you need to convert that media into a format that the TV has no trouble playing. TVs tend to be more limited than things like Plex on a Google TV can play almost anything. I'm not sure what the capabilities are of the WD Box, but... obviously, they're more limited.
Right.
It would be great. That's the other way to go. Apple TV is very limited, for instance. It only plays back a handful of file formats. It would be great to have, I think Boxy, I like the Boxy Box quite a bit. That's from D-Link. That's running the Boxy software, which is excellent software, and that can handle almost anything.
Is that something that Best Buy or those types of?
Yeah, we're online. I don't know what Best Buy carries, but we're online. If you have an Xbox 360, you have a media extender. It is a very powerful computer that can handle almost anything. And it's good with Windows over there. Yeah. So there are lots, there are a lot of ways to solve this. The issue is, multifaceted. You need to have a way to get data into your TV. You have a format that that thing can play. PS3 is also quite good, the PlayStation 3. A lot of people, because they already have gaming systems hooked up to their computer, their televisions, that's what they should be using. If you have an Xbox 360 or PS3, look at solutions involving that. Both of them have hard drives, have a lot of space, and so forth. Hey, coming up, the guy who sued AT&T in small claims court for throttling him and won. Matt Spaccarelli joins us right after this. Hey, I want to talk a little bit about, before we go on, about my good friends at Stamps.com. You're familiar with Stamps.com, I hope, by now. I've talked about them an awful lot. I just love Stamps.com, and they decided to sponsor the Tech Guy podcast. They're already sponsoring the show, but they're on the podcast now. And I think they've just told us they want to sponsor some of our other shows. And I'm thrilled about that. I am really thrilled about that. Stamps, visit them right now online. You can see what they're up to. Stamps.com. And in fact, you might be tempted when you get there to say, oh, I'll take that $80 free offer. Wait, because I'm going to tell you a better way. $110 bonus offer. So what is Stamps.com? It's a website for the Mac. It's software for the PC that lets you print postage, U.S. postage, from your computer and printer. No special ink. You don't need a postage meter. It basically turns your system into a postage meter. The special offer comes with this USB scale that I just love, because then you're always, you know, you're always got the right postage. You just plug this in. You put your stuff on there. You plug it in, and you're good to go. I just love that idea. So it's USB. And then one of the best things about that is, you don't have to go to the post office, even if it's a package over 13 ounces. Your mail carrier just picks it up. Because Stamps.com actually puts a, you know, they put a barcode on there, and the post office says, that's fine. We don't, you know, that's good. We know who you are, and you're golden. So any size package, letter, postcard, whatever, always have the right postage, even when they raise the rates, which you're about to do. Never wait in line at the post office. And there are additional value features. For instance, if you're an eBay seller and an Amazon seller, it automates that whole system for you. You get discounts you can't even get at the post office. 21% off express mail, 15% off priority mail. If you do international shipping, you might say, oh, it's U.S. only. No, no. In fact, it's great for international, because not only do they print the right postage, but they also fill out all the international forms. If you use QuickBooks, it'll do it right from your QuickBooks address book. Stamps.com is just the best way to kind of automate your whole mail process. It brings the post office to your desk. For a small business or anybody who does a lot of mailing, this is fantastic. I've been using them for almost 10 years now, and I want you to try it. Now, here comes a special offer. I think this is a pretty good deal. It is just go to the Stamps.com, click that radio microphone, and use the offer code TECHGUY, okay? One word. You get a $110 bonus offer. That's the digital scale. That's free, yours to keep, worth $50. $55 in postage coupons and a 4-week trial, all free. Just go to stamps.com and use the offer code TECHGUY. Stamps.com is amazing. If you haven't tried it yet, this is a great opportunity to try it for free. $55 free postage. They're paying you to try it. Stamps.com. I love it. I have to keep, every time I do the ad, I have to steal this from the front desk. Give me that scale. No. You know, I didn't confront the drop cam people with my thoughts. I don't know if John has talked to them about it. We do want a better quality camera. I just don't know. We're looking for the best quality, because I really want the spy cam to work well. We got a lot of Michiganers in the house. They're also from Michigan. Don and Faye. Oh, did they leave? They left. Oh, yeah. Jennifer and Paul from the Bay Area. You're at Monster. That's right. Yeah.
MEGA, upload to me today. Send me a file.
We're gonna get pulled down. I guess Kim.com, who was. I actually asked Steve Martin about piracy and so forth, because he has records, he's got movies, he's got, I mean, this is a guy who's books. And he said, you know, the thing that bugged him the most was somebody who takes somebody's hard work and then sells it and makes money off of it without having anything to do with it. And he felt like that's kind of what Mega Upload, because he said, Kim.com, this guy is was, you know, had many cars, boats. This guy was living the life of, you know, of a king, of a prince in New Zealand. And he said that's the thing that bugged him, is that he was getting rich off of it. He said he loved Napster when it came out. He said, oh, man, I got connected with all sorts of music I hadn't heard in years. I think a lot of us had that experience. Napster got me back into music. So Steve said, I got to get that interview in, and we'll play a little. Maybe tomorrow we'll play a little bit of it for you. Hey, online with us right now, Matt Spaccarelli. He is the guy who sued in Ventura County in Simi Valley. Saying, hey, AT&T, you promised me on my iPhone unlimited access. After somewhere between 1.5 and 2 gigabytes of downloads, you throttled me. I want my money, and got an $850 judgment. Matt, thank you for joining us. You're a hero to a lot of people today.
Oh, thank you very much.
So what prompted you? Did you just see red? Is that what prompted all of this?
No, you know, I had talked to AT&T over and over and over again, to all the customer service representatives, and I've been just trying to find out what the top 5% consists of and how they figure it, whether it's all of users, which is what I assumed it was based on the text messages that they sent me, and then I come to find out that it's in your market. Well, then if it's in your market, what constitutes a market? Is it a 4-block radius so that they can switch people over to the tiered plan?
Good point.
You know, and then I found out they could really charge or change it arbitrarily however they want, you know. So if one area, let's say in Simi Valley, is using more data than another area, well, we'll just make this a 5% area. And I noticed that originally I would get slowed down at 10 gigs and then 8 gigs and 5, you know, and then it was like 1.5 to 2. And I get the text and I'm like, wait a minute, you know. It's one thing to keep it at a certain level. But it just got out of hand. So I called the executive support team at AT&T, and I talked to a lady there, and she kind of blew me off. And was, you know, very sarcastic.
Really?
And, I said, you know what? I think her name was can I give her name?
Mm-hmm. Sure you can.
I think it was Danita Baguez, or, you know, it all...
What did she say to you that was sarcastic? She said... Oh, you're just bandwidth hog?
I was talking to her about bandwidth and the bandwidth crunch and how they do the backhaul now with HSPA Plus. And
you knew way more than the average customer, and I'm sure she didn't like hearing that at all.
Well, and what I told her is I said, look...
knowledge is power.
AT&T made a bad decision. When they first came out with the iPhone, everyone was getting those crazy bills.
Right.
And then they said, well, we're going to stop this. We're going to give everyone unlimited because we didn't realize how much data it took. So then they switched everyone to an unlimited plan. Then they made everyone have an unlimited plan. I don't know if you remember, it used to say, if you get an iPhone, you got to have this plan.
Right.
And you cannot have an iPhone without a data plan.
Right.
So then they forced everyone to be on unlimited, which was fine. That's what I wanted.
Hey, anyway. I was happy. Yeah. I didn't complain.
Then they decided to change that and say, well, now you guys are using too much, so we got to figure out a way to get you off of it. Now, here's the thing. AT&T has the right to say, we're not going to do unlimited anymore. When your contract is up, we're switching you to a tiered plan, whether you like it or not, and that's that. They can do that. But that's not what they did.
They decided instead to say it's unlimited, but if you use more than a pittance, which are 1.5 to 2 gigabytes is a pittance, then we're going to slow you down so much that you won't even want to use it.
Right. So when I was talking to this lady, I said, look, you guys made the mistake with the bandwidth problem, and it's not right. I mean, and then she said, what do you want us to do, cut our own throats? I'm like, seriously, did you just say that to me? Because, I mean, you guys are the largest telecommunications company in the world, and I just want what you told me I was going to get. And she said, well, there's nothing I could do for you. And I said, all right, I'm going to go file it in small claims. And that day I went over to the courthouse a mile away and filed it.
Matt, that's right on. Right on.
And that's how it went. And it's just like, you know, I'm sorry, I'm nervous. But
don't be nervous. No, you're a hero. I think there are a lot of people going, wow, this is what I should have done. Now, AT&T says they're going to appeal it. Have they told you that yet?
No, I haven't heard anything. AT&T, they have 30 days in the court process that I went through. They have 30 days to appeal. Now, I wasn't actually given a judgment in writing. The judge mailed it to you.
Right.
And
so this just happened on Friday, so you haven't received anything.
Right.
Monday, you'll probably. Now, let me ask you, how long did this take, and what was the process?
It's a very easy process. A friend of mine is going to help me put up a website and give all this information.
Good.
All the information that I took into court, I'm just going to let people have it.
Did AT&T show up and defend it, or did they just...
Yeah. In fact, the guy that was sitting next to me, who did a really good job, by the way, I was asking him before our time up with the judge. I'm like, hey, you know, how do these things usually go? And when I do these things, I get really nervous. I thought I was going to pass out. And he's like, hi, you think this is the first one we've had to deal with? And, you know, he's kind of a little bit smug about it.
Sure.
But not in a bad way.
He wants to intimidate you, though. Of course he does.
And the guy from the Associated Press was sitting right in front of us, and he didn't know that, and I didn't know that. Ooh. And he's like, yeah, what was that all about? I heard him talking about that. And I'm, you know, so when we actually got up there, you know, he did a really good job, but I had so much documentation. I brought 300 pages. The judge made a joke about it. When I rolled my suitcase in, he says, like, this is going to be fun. and then the AT&T guy says, yeah, tell me about it. That's all his stuff. And it went really well. I mean,
did the judge say anything to you that indicated he understood what was going on, that he was sympathetic, or did you say, now you win?
Oh, no. He gave us a lecture. He said, look, there's a saying that goes around the court places, and it's justice happens in small claims. And he went on to explain that before he gave a ruling.
Wow.
And he said, you know, if you have class actions and big lawsuits and you have these attorneys and they have thousands of pages of documents and they just bury you with this stuff. But in small claims, you actually have a guy and another guy, you know, pleading their case, saying what they want to say. It's very informal and justice can actually happen. Then he went on to give his ruling. And the reason why I sued for $10,000 is in the contract it says that there's arbitration. AT&T has an alternative payment that if you win anything in arbitration, they automatically give you a minimum of $10,000 plus double your attorney's fees and double your court costs. And small claims is in the same paragraph that it talks about that, so I assumed it applied. The judge says, I don't think that applies to small claims, but I have to put a monetary value on this, so what are your damages? I just picked a number because for me, it's not about the money. It was about the point. And I said, look, let's say I use 10 gigs, you know, which I use more than that on when I'm not throttled because I watch Netflix.
Matt, hold on just a sec because I want to talk some more to you. Matt Spaccarelli just won a big case against AT&T. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Little Robin Hood action there because we've got a modern day Robin Hood on the line. Matt Spaccarelli. Am I saying your name right, Matt?
Hey. Yes, Spaccarelli.
Spaccarelli. Took AT&T, Ma Bell, to court and won in small claims court $850 on Friday. The judge ruled that AT&T had misrepresented things when they said that Matt had an unlimited data plan on his iPhone, and then after he used 1.5 to 2 gigabytes, decided to throttle him down almost nothing. And you were talking about why you chose $850. You said that's what you felt like the damages were.
Right. We just picked a number, and we just figured an average of 10 gigs. And then he said, well, how much would it cost if he had to buy 10 gigs worth of data? And I said $100. The AT&T guy said like $65 extra. And the judge says, I'm putting it in the middle at 85 because that sounds reasonable.
And, so it's 850, which is 85 times 10.
My contract ends, I think, in October, and he said for 10 months, I think.
I get it. Will you stay with AT&T when your contract runs out?
I hope so. I wasn't really listening to the judge because I was so happy that I won. But where I live, AT&T is the only provider that I can get. I'm just outside of the fringe of Verizon and everybody else. So I've got no choice but AT&T. But the service is great. I mean, I get great reception where I'm at. It's fast internet when it's on. And
when it's throttled, how slow does it get?
My average is 0.26 megabits per second.
Ooh.
And the night before court, I did a speed test. The FCC has a speed checking website, which is run by Ookaloo, I think.
Ookla,
they made
yeah.
the app for him, I
yeah.
guess.
Yeah.
And the night before court, when I brought this in, I was getting 5 megabits per second and on my iPad, which was unthrottled, and I got 0.26 on my iPhone, which was throttled.
Wow, they really throttle it. 260 kilobits a second is very slow. That's barely edge speed. That's really slow.
And the thing that I brought up in court, too, is instead of going from 5 to 0.26, why don't you just give me 1 megabit per second, because that's enough to watch Netflix.
Right.
You know, why so low? Why so slow that, you know, it just doesn't work? And AT&T's website says that Netflix takes 5.1 megabytes of data per minute. And at 1 megabit per second, you're getting over that. You're getting like 11 or 10 or something like that.
Right. So that's what it was that uses up all the bandwidth? That's what you do on your iPhone, that you watch Netflix?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. You know, I come home and lay down in bed and put Netflix on.
But you don't do it on your iPad. I think you'd do it on your iPad.
Well, the iPad is not unlimited data.
Oh.
I mean, you get 2 megabytes for sure. $25 or
That's
something
right.
like that.
So you do it on your unlimited device. That makes sense.
Yeah, I just do it on my iPhone. I plug that little connection kit in and put it on my projector onto my spandex screen, and it looks beautiful.
When the judge ruled in your favor, did the AT&T guy go,
He just stood there, and right afterwards, man, he took off out of there real quick. The AP guy tried to stop him to get a statement. He's, you know,
boy, I think that was it just a coincidence that a reporter was in the courtroom, or
no, it wasn't a coincidence. No, I called him. I saw a story that he did.
So you called the press and said, hey, you might want to be here for this.
Well, I posted a comment on his on the article. And saying, hey, you know what, I'm trying to decide if I want to sue AT&T over this. Anybody got, you know, any advice or maybe some questions I could ask them and some stuff like that. I actually emailed you, too, beforehand and said the same thing. Hey, I'm thinking about suing AT&T. And then last night I dropped you another email saying, hey, I won.
Oh, man, I'm kicking myself now. I can't believe it. I got to start reading my email, Matt. Thank you. Congratulations. And
well,
I apologize.
I know that you get a ton of email.
I do.
I know that you get a ton of email, and that's what it said. And it said, if you still want the email address, go ahead and try. So I gave it a shot.
I
and,
see it right here.
I'm a big fan of the
2:41 a.m. I sued AT&T and won.
I guess that was last night.
You must feel so good. Yeah. Did you celebrate when you got home? Did you get open a bottle of champagne?
No, I mean, I'm a simple guy. You know, I was happy. I talked to my friends, and I was on cloud nine. You know, I talked to my girlfriend, and
that's so great.
Man, I can't believe it. You know, and you know, I thought that this was a pretty big deal, but not this big.
Well, you're getting press all over the world on this.
I hope it just encourages other people to do the same, because it's not fair.
Yeah, and you say you want to start a website that would tell people how to do what you did.
Yeah, a friend of mine already put something up. I guess it's not finished, but if I can give that address out, that'd be great.
Yeah, please do. What is it?
TapoRC. It's TapoRC.com.
TapoRC.com. We'll put that in our show notes if people want to know more. And I have found your email and the case report and the Spaccarelli versus AT&T Mobility and all of that. And thank you for sending me that email. And I really apologize for not responding. Had I read my email, I would have responded back and wished you the best. And I would have said you don't have a chance in heck.
It's not a big deal. I'm sure you're a busy guy.
I just missed it. It was Valentine's Day, and I missed it. But I am so, so thrilled for you. And I am grateful to you because I think you've raised such an important point, and you're absolutely right. And I'm glad that the judge felt the same way. And stay in touch, because I presume AT&T has said they want to appeal this, so I presume they're going to.
Right.
Because that's...
Can I make one more point?
Yeah.
In court, the AT&T representative was trying to say that peer-to-peer stuff is not allowed on AT&T's network, and he called Netflix peer-to-peer. Now, you're the tech guy, so
no,
I don't know...
No, it's not peer-to-peer.
my argument was peer-to-peer is if I hook my computer up to the judges and we're swapping information.
Right.
Netflix streams information, so it's not peer-to-peer. So when I was sitting there in court, I pulled up AT&T's website, saw an Acer computer that came installed with mobile broadband and Netflix pre-installed.
Yeah.
And showed that to the judge. And I'm like, that's not peer-to-peer.
Oh, man, you're good, Matthew. You should be a lawyer. You got to go to law school now.
Nah, I'm just kidding.
Well done. No, you're absolutely right. It's a classic client server situation where they serve movies to a client and they don't use bandwidth from other people. They don't. There's no peer to peer. There's no sharing of bandwidth. And by the way, I don't know why they wouldn't allow peer to peer anyway. That's another question entirely. They're selling you the bandwidth. You should be able to use it any way you want to, as long as it's legal, and peer to peer is legal. So,
I agree.
But you're absolutely right. It isn't peer-to-peer. Netflix is, and they're selling it. They want people to use Netflix. They just don't want them to use it too much.
See, I didn't know that for sure, but I just didn't. I figured peer-to-peer was person-to-person.
You were right.
And Netflix isn't a person. It's a business.
Right. Hey, I really appreciate you taking some time to talk to us, Matt, and I do apologize. I found both your emails now, one on Valentine's Day and one from 2:41 a.m. last night. I'm so glad you called in to the show and we could get you on. And I'm going to email you back because I think we'd like to get you on some of our other shows because I think you've done something for all of us here.
Yeah, I really appreciate you taking the call and taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you, Matt. So, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Great to talk to you. Matt Spaccarelli, who on Friday won one for the little guy. All of us against AT&T. There isn't a bigger guy than AT&T. There's no bigger Goliath out there. And he took his slingshot and knocked the giant down. We'll stay in touch, Matt, and find out what happens going forward. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Wow, that is a great story. That is a great story. And it underscores that we do have a justice system that works. And I think the judge was right. I think and everybody talks about, you know, politics in general is best served local. You know, if you want to get something done, get it done locally. High five from the chat room to you, Matt. And I have his address. We'll get him on some of more shows in just a bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Kyle Benham, our musical director, does it again. Is that the Clash or is that the...
A parody with the Dead Kennedys.
It's the Dead Kennedys. That's who it is, yeah. Jello Biafra. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. You know, there is a larger point on what AT&T is doing that I think is kind of interesting. It turns out that throttling is not, and by the way, AT&T is not the only internet service provider to do this. Comcast limits you to 250 gigabytes. It is not the best way to fight congestion. In fact, it's ineffective, and we now have studies from a number of prestigious universities that demonstrate this. Bandwidth caps do not, in fact, ease congestion. Throttling even doesn't really ease congestion because the problem is there is plenty of bandwidth. It's when it's being used that causes congestion. It's everybody using it at the same time that causes congestion. There's a good article from a friend of mine who's the founder of an internet service provider called SonicNet. His name is Dane Jasper. Dane offered data from SonicNet users to a study to figure out, they called it a bandwidth usage reality check, to figure out if, in fact, bandwidth caps would help congestion. And what happens in this study, it says data caps are a very crude and unfair tool when it comes to targeting potentially disruptive users. Throttling is similar to data caps, the same kind of idea where you go after the bandwidth hogs by either slowing them down or cutting them off. This study said that the correlation between real-time bandwidth use and data downloaded over time is weak. The net cast by data caps captures users that cannot possibly be responsible for congestion. The study shows that people like Matt, in fact, are not the problem. In fact, many users who are as guilty as the ones who are over cap are not captured by that same net. The real bandwidth hogs, in fact, are not punished by data caps and throttling. Now, it's a little bit difficult to understand. It's kind of counterintuitive, but there is lots of evidence for this. And Dane Jasper's opinion is that it really, these caps are not so much about easing congestion. They're about protecting business interests. Remember that AT&T has a product called U-verse that Comcast sells TV. These companies don't want you watching Netflix because it undermines their own business. It's to protect television, not to protect bandwidth. That's assuming they're smart enough to understand this data cap issue. And I'm sure they are. They have smart engineers who are, I am sure, telling management, look, it doesn't matter if you cap people or throttle people. That's not going to help us with congestion. ISPs face their biggest traffic loads in the late afternoon through about 11 p.m. as home internet users come home, check their email, romp on Facebook, watch Netflix or YouTube or Amazon or Apple. At that time, these so-called data hogs are not really any more piggish than anyone else. The problem is that the internet service provider's network is congested because so many people are using it at the same time. It's because users swarm. They go in bunches. That same network at 11 a.m. is wide open. Usage caps are a blunt, inaccurate tool to control network congestion. And these companies know it. What they really are trying to do is keep people from Matt, like Matt, from watching Netflix, period. They don't want you using your phone, your iPad, your computer to undermine their business selling you television. Watch cable. Watch U-verse. Don't use it to watch Netflix. No. In fact, data caps in this article, and I'll give you a link to this, punish not data hogs. 85% of bandwidth consumption during peak hours does not come, 85% of bandwidth consumption during peak hours does not come from the heaviest data users. I know that's counterintuitive, but it's because we're all watching at the same time, not because we're using so much bandwidth. The bandwidth hogs are all over the time, all over the clock. Data caps do a very poor job of punishing people for causing network congestion because they punish the wrong people. Or do they? Who they really punish is people who are watching Netflix. That's who they punish. Dane writes, most of the United States' leading ISPs, Comcast, Time Warner, Verizon, AT&T, Charter, and Cablevision also offer, what, television and voice services. Those triple play bundles where they take phone, TV, and internet all into one bill. Those are very profitable. The most expensive portion of that is the video portion. So the cable television service is usually the biggest part of your triple play bill. The problem is consumers are increasingly using their internet portion to watch TV, the cheap part, like Netflix and Amazon Video On Demand and Hulu, instead of the profitable cable television service. These guys are protecting that business, I think. So, it's really part of this changing landscape that we see in so many businesses where the internet has changed how business works. Businesses fight, always. They fight to preserve the status quo. They don't want to change. The movie industry, the television industry, the music industry, they didn't want to change your business model, but the internet and technology is changing it. So they fight. They fight to preserve it. And what happens is we suffer. And we don't get to use it in the way that we want to, the way that we're paying for it. So I'm glad that people like Matt are standing up and saying, hey, that's not right. And what's great is there are internet service providers like DSL Extreme, like SonicNet, who don't do this, who don't cap, because they're not in the television business. Dane says, hey, use all the bandwidth you want. We'll make more. All right, now let's go to line five. Ed is in Santa Barbara, California. Hi, Ed. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Leo, thank you for taking the call.
My pleasure. Thanks for holding on.
Well, you stated it very nicely just a moment ago. My problem has been with Explorer in Windows 7 Professional. It does just what you just stated. It,
do you have
does not function.
Have you? You got another browser on your system, like Firefox or Chrome, just to see? Hold on, hold on, Ed. Now you do have Firefox. I'll tell you what. Hang on a second. We got to take a break for your local news. We'll be right back, and maybe we can do some diagnosis here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, helping you one computer at a time. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. If you've got a question or comment about technology, 888-827-5536. We were talking to Ed in Santa Barbara, who's got something wrong with his system. His Internet Explorer doesn't work.
No. Not Internet Explorer.
Oh, Explorer. Windows. Ah. So Firefox is not the issue. All right. I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah. No, when you asked about the other...
I get it.
It's the problem. If I go into, say, a documents, go to a folder, anytime I try to right-click on anything, I have to wait anywhere from a minute and a half to 3.5 minutes for something to open up.
That's so the way Windows works with the right-click is it actually has a folder, a contextual folder, with right-click commands in it. And it does scan that folder every time you right-click. Now, it should cache that information, which should speed it up, but it sounds like it's not caching it. And so what we probably want to do is look at the contextual menu folder. That's what that's called, is a contextual menu. And or it may be in the registry as well. And make sure that we don't have some corruption or that there's not a lot of stuff in there that's causing a problem. So here's where we'll start. When it finally does pop up, is there a lot of stuff in there in that right-click menu?
Well, just the usual things in the drop-down menu.
Right.
You know, I mean, it gives me the options to delete and, you know, all the other stuff that's normally in there.
Right. Probably the first place to look is in your registry. Now, it's always, you know, a little risky and tricky messing with the registry because you have to use a registry editor. And if you mess something up, you can mess up your install of Windows. But I think that's probably the first place to look.
Okay.
Have you ever done anything with a registry editor before?
Well, yeah, not on my own. Usually with help from a tech or something like that.
Right. So there is a registry key called Shell X. That's for shell extensions. It's in H key classes root directory Shell X. That's the context menu handlers. You know what? I'm going to recommend a utility to do this because there are some utilities that will let you do this without messing with a registry. They'll go directly to it. A company called Nirsoft, NIRSOFT, makes these. N is in nobody.
NIR Soft.
Nirsoft, yeah. It's nirsoft.com. I think. Wait a minute. No, it's not. I'm going to have to Google it now because it's not. It's nirsoft.net. NIRSOFT.net. And they're all free and really useful little utilities for messing around with Windows. They have a pass and password recovery utilities, network monitoring tools. And they also have a Shell X View program that really all it's doing is what the registry editor do it, but it's doing it in a way that you can't get in as much trouble. And it'll look and see what's in your shell extensions, and you can disable them. So I would do that first and see. You may just have, you know, as you every time you install programs, they often add stuff to the contextual menus. And the more stuff that's in there, the slower it's going to be popping up. So you might just want to clean that up.
Contextual menus?
Yeah, that's what that right click is a contextual menu. They call it that because it's a context aware, right? So it knows, you know, when you right click on something, it's aware of what you're right clicking on, and it gives you a menu that changes depending on what you're right clicking on. So it's contextually aware, or a context menu, and they do this with extensions to the shell. There are a number of utilities Nearsoft offers that will allow you to clean this up, disable programs in the shell extensions. It's my sense that that's probably what's wrong. It works. It's just that it does work. It's just that it's slow. SHEX view, I guess, shell X view. The chat room's given us a lot of utilities that Nearsoft offers. There's also, you know what? Shell menu view might be more appropriate. There's a whole bunch of these from Nearsoft. This might be more appropriate. A shell menu view is a small utility that displays the list of static menu items that appear in the context menu when you right click on a file or folder in Explorer, and allows you to disable unwanted menu items. So I turn off everything you don't use. See if that speeds things up. I wonder if there's a way to re-index that stuff. Because what I'm sure Windows does is kind of cache that information. Because otherwise it would have to scan through the registry each time to build that menu. It would just take forever. So I imagine there's a cache somewhere. I'd be my guess that cache is corrupted. But maybe just modifying what's there would do that. Jed in Turlock, California, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jed.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing okay. So now, a while back, you had said, you had theorized that the Apple Macintosh guest user account performs an auto-delete.
Right.
Okay, so at what point does it do that? Because my computer froze up, so I never actually logged out of the guest user account. And I never logged back in.
That's a good question. I do not know. Maybe the chat room does. It was the chat room that told me. I didn't even know this. When you use that guest account on your Mac, when you log in, as you log out, it deletes whatever you've done so that account is always fresh. That has two benefits. One is it preserves anonymity, so you can use the guest account, and that information won't be preserved across logins. And the second, of course, is that it, you know, reverses any damage you've done to the system, so the guest account is always good there. When it crashed before you saw that warning saying, I'm going to delete all this data, right?
Yes, it froze right in the middle of doing stuff, and I was going to put all that stuff that I'd saved. Don't ask me why I saved anything in the guest user account. I don't even remember why I stupidly did that, but I was going to put it on a thumb drive before I restarted.
Right. Which is one way to preserve that, actually, yeah. So you could work in the guest account as long as you copied the files that you created somewhere else.
Except it's not a good idea, because sometimes it'll just, you know, for some reason,
crash. I think it's still going to be there. I think that it would, you know, it just stands to reason. It's not going to mess with those files while you're logged in. It's only on logout that it's going to delete them. In fact, in most cases, it would only be after logout that it would have access to them. So if you never did get to log out, I bet you that stuff still would be there. Doesn't mean you can access it.
Yeah, how would you theorize that?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, if you look at your user accounts,
I have admin privileges to the computer.
Yeah. Well, I would look in there's a users folder on the computer. I would look in there.
Right.
And let me just see what the guest account looks like on that. Actually, I'm actually not sure. Users. It doesn't even say. It doesn't even say there's a guest account. So it may be a hidden account. That's interesting. They're shared, but that's not the same. I would guess, now I'm thinking, that account is created when you log in and deleted in its entirety when you log out. If you crashed, that's what I would do. I would go into the computer users folder and see if there's...
I did that, and I found there was a guest users account in there.
Ah, good.
It wasn't deleted.
Good. Yeah. So since you have admin privileges, copy the contents of that folder somewhere else before you do anything else.
I couldn't find the individual files that I was looking for, though, but you think they might be invisible?
They might be. Yeah. You might browse them with a, you know, something that doesn't depend on them being visible. You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I do not know. You won't see this unless it's enabled in your system. Mine is enabled. It's a good question. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So I'd have to probably use terminal. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Just messing around with my Mac, causing problems here, just to see what happens. So I crashed the system. I logged into a guest account. Guest accounts have to be enabled on the Mac, and they do warn you when you log in and log out that we're going to erase all data. Nothing will be preserved across sessions. And so what I did is I created a some data in a guest account and then crashed the computer. I'm a daredevil. I love living dangerously. And now the issue is I can see that folder there, but of course I don't have access to it. Even as an admin, you have to have full permission. Now, you can probably, let me just try some Unix commands. I could probably sudo into it. All right. Let's just try logging in here as a super user. This is fun, isn't it? This is great radio. No, it didn't work. So I would think you could get in there if you had the right permissions. It is locked, obviously. And I cannot tell you. I'll be honest, I don't know if that data is still there because I can't look at it. I'll have to probably get in as root. I'll play with this in the next break. I would guess that as long as you don't now log out your computer, don't do anything. Copy, you know, you got to do this all before you reboot or log out. You should be able to get that data there somewhere. Sudo did not work, however. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask. Leo, Joe's in New York. Our next caller. Hi, Joe. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. I have myself a Logitech S520 wireless keyboard mouse combination.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you kind of got me thinking with this WPA2 bug about, you know, having things encrypted. I'm thinking, boy, that's wonderful to log on to my bank's website or something like that and typing in my passcodes and all that. But if I do it on this wireless keyboard, is that going to be encrypted?
Oh, you asked a great question. Yeah. So it depends on how the keyboard, the wireless keyboard, treats your data. Early wireless keyboards did sort of scramble your data, but they did it using ROT13. They did it with such a simple algorithm that it would be trivial to see what was going on. And so wireless keyboards were, in fact, hackable, very hackable, for a long time. Once hackers figured this out, Logitech and others, Microsoft, others who make wireless keyboards, did a little bit of a better job encrypting it. So the question is, in fact, Logitech has a trademark on something called Secure Connect, a major leap in the cordless desktop experience in which they are, in fact, now using actual encryption on the cordless stuff. So the question is, if your keyboard supports Secure Connect, do you know?
I don't know the answer to that one. Sorry.
Yeah. So, and I could look up that model number, but I think it'd probably be easier if you do. It's fairly recent, right?
I think I bought it last year.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So it's kind of interesting because what happens is that these keyboards do a lot more using RFID tags to secure your data. So older keyboards, no, they weren't secure, and it was trivial to hack them. Now, remember, Joe, somebody's got to be kind of close enough to be able to see that wireless signal. Most of the hacks that I know of occurred in an office where, you know, your office mate in the cubicle over was close enough to be able to capture your wireless signals and read it. Somebody outside the building? Probably not.
Yeah, well, my neighbor is like 83 years old or something.
I think you're safe.
She's going to be getting into it.
She could be. You know, there are 83-year-old hackers, I'm sure, but...
And the other neighbor on the other side is, vacant house now. They just sold the house. But I must thank you for streaming your program, because while we have premier radio affiliates in Buffalo, New York, they don't carry your show.
Yeah, we're working. The show is, I'm very pleased to say, a huge success. You know, I think Premier took a bit of a gamble 3 years ago when they said, yeah, syndicate technology, we'll try it. And this show has been sold out. Advertisers love it. And we're in 170 cities in the U.S., which is a goodly number. But there are a few, like Buffalo, where we're not. We're working on it. I would like to be in every city in the country, of course. But thank goodness the Internet gets everywhere. It's like water. It seeps. Thank you, Joe. I appreciate it. I'm really glad you asked the question. We've talked a little bit about this on our Security Now podcast. That's how I know. It's very common, by the way, that when stuff comes out at first, nobody pays any attention to security. So when wireless keyboards from Microsoft, Logitech, and others came out at first, people just, you know, oh, we'll do ROT 13. That should be enough. And it was trivial to reverse it. And they paid no attention to security until somebody hacked it. In fact, there's some really interesting stories of they call this white hat hacking, where a company will hire a hacker to test their security. And there's some very famous stories of a white hat hacker sitting outside a major Fortune 500 company on the curb and using things like wireless keyboards to get so much information about this company and then come back with a report to the CEO saying, yeah. As a matter of fact, by sitting out in the curb, I was able to find out all this stuff, and it freaked them out. So most companies now have much more secure. What you're looking for is true encryption of some sort on that keyboard. And in fact, Logitech does it. They have a trademark. It is strong encryption. They call it Secure Connect. Relatively strong. It's not super strong, but strong enough. I believe Apple and Microsoft are also doing that. But you should. That's something you should look for if you're worried, especially if you're going to use these in an office, because then somebody's close enough that they could, you know, obviously they could snoop on what you're typing. Gareth in Birmingham, UK, via Skype. Hi, Gareth. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm well. Welcome. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm having problems with my desktop. I think the motherboard died.
Uh-oh.
But I just wanted to run it past you first before I go and buy a new one.
Okay.
Started having a few problems, getting blue screens of death and such like. It's running Windows 7, or was running Windows 7. So I thought it might be a hard drive problem.
Mm-hmm.
Tried running a Linux live disk when it wouldn't boot at all.
Very smart. That's a really great technique for diagnosing problems. Linux is a free operating system, often distributed on CD, often distributed on CDs that called live disks that you can boot from. You boot from the CD, and now, even if your hard drive's dead, you're running the computer off the CD. It's a great way to diagnose if the problem is hardware, software, the hard drive, that kind of thing.
Yeah. When I ran it, it was asking me to load drivers for the hard drive.
Right.
Not just the operating system hard drive, both the hard drives that were in there.
All right. Hang on, Gareth. We're going to take a break and come back. I know you're on Skype, so it won't cost you anything. Hang in there. We'll get to you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We were talking to Gareth, who is on the line from Birmingham. Thanks for letting me put you on hold, Gareth.
Yeah,
so your computer doesn't work at all?
Not now.
You said what was the error message Windows gave you when you tried to boot before you did the Linux boot? What happened? What did you see? A blank screen? Did you see?
It blue screened.
It blue screened. Okay.
Completely wouldn't even get.
And when you try to boot up through a Linux disk, it says I don't see the hard drive. I need a driver.
Yeah, and that was just, it wasn't just the one hard drive, it was both the hard drives that were in there. And I've never seen that with Linux before, which confused me.
Yeah, that confuses me as well. Which version of Linux were you using?
It was Ubuntu 11.4, I think it was.
Oh, all right. So it was very, it was, I think, 11.04, but it was a very recent version of Ubuntu. So it should have seen if it was a SATA drive or whatever. You know, I think it's almost certain, Gareth, that your hard drive is dead.
Now, the only reason that I think it might not be the hard drive and be the motherboard instead is I managed to get an install of Windows 7 onto an IDE hard drive, which I put in there.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't, when I set the BIOS settings to boot from the IDE rather than the SATA drives, it wouldn't boot from it, which made me think it might be something related to something on the motherboard not recognizing drives and...
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you think about it, a motherboard, which is the mother of all circuit boards in your computer, has, among other things, hard drive controller circuitry on it.
Yeah.
And it's completely possible, just as it would be for an external hard drive controller or one that's in a card slot, for that hard drive controller circuitry to be shot. It's not likely. Solid state stuff doesn't go bad very easily, but it could have gone bad.
There was something that made me think it might be that as well. I have an external hard drive, which is powered from the mains, and a couple of times when I turned that on, it brought the whole desktop down.
Oh,
which makes me think
that's
not
good. Yeah, if a sometimes USB devices will do that, and that usually does indicate a fairly serious problem in the motherboard. Is it the motherboard has both IDE and SATA on it?
It does, yeah.
Yeah, so it's fairly old.
It's about 4 years old.
It's also possible that it could be, and this might be worth a try. As you know, I'm sure the motherboard keeps track of what kinds of stuff is installed on it with an area of non-volatile memory called CMOS. It uses something called ESCD, Enhanced System Configuration Data, stored on the CMOS. If that's corrupted, if it's damaged, if the battery that's backing it up died, or just a little stray signal damaged it, it might confuse the motherboard about what's going on there. So... I would suggest, can you get into BIOS?
I can get into BIOS, yeah.
Okay, so you can run the BIOS setup. There usually is on a system that old a setting to rebuild the ESCD. You might try that. Does the BIOS see the hard drives?
It sees the hard drives, but when I've changed the drive order, it doesn't take notice of me changing the drive order.
Yeah, that worries me a little bit that the motherboard might be gone.
Yeah.
It's unlikely that it's both hard drives or that third hard drive. So it sounds like it's the motherboard. Try replacing the battery. It's those little lithium batteries. They're coin size. They're not expensive. If it's dead, it might be that the motherboard defaults to some setting that can't see hard drives. So replace that battery, then reset the ESCD and see if it's okay. I presume your hard drives aren't encrypted and it's nothing like that. Does sound like some hardware is messed up. The good news is motherboards, 4-year-old motherboard, they're cheap. You can replace it. You'd get a new processor. You get something a little faster. I think you'd be better off. As we talked about Linux, the chat room has been urging me to talk a little bit about Ubuntu, Ubuntu Linux. Ubuntu is a company that was started by Mark Shuttleworth, who made a lot of money in the old .com days, and decided, I'm going to put this money into something valuable. I'm going to support this free operating system, give it away. You can even go to Ubuntu.com, Ubuntu.com, and get a free disk. They'll just mail you a disk, which is very useful for situations like this. You can boot to the disk. But now they're offering, which I find kind of intriguing, an Ubuntu for Android. They're saying, which I think is kind of intriguing, that nowadays, because the new smartphones are dual core and very fast, they make excellent desktop computers. All you do is get an HDMI cable. most of these Android phones now, you have HDMI out. Hook it up to a big monitor, get a Bluetooth keyboard and mouse, and you're carrying in your pocket a very fast computer. And I guess you put Linux on it, and you can use it as a desktop. I have seen people do this with their phones with just Android, and it's kind of intriguing. I'm not sure what the market is for this or why they decided to get into it, but Ubuntu for Android is kind of interesting. At CES, they also demonstrated Ubuntu TV, which is a form of this Ubuntu Linux designed for home theater PCs. I think Mark's saying is we want Linux everywhere. You know, ironically, they may have won that because Android is a form of Linux itself. And most TVs, including the Samsung 3D TV behind me, are running Linux as their operating system. So, and most websites are running on Linux as well, including our website, techguylabs.com. So you use Linux more than you more than you might realize. Larry in Dover, Delaware, you're next. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome to the show.
Hello, Leo.
Welcome. Hello. How are you, Larry?
I'm just fine, Leo. Well, actually, not that fine, or I guess I wouldn't be calling you.
No, everybody calls me when they're in trouble with their computers.
Well, that's me all over.
I signed up for the job.
The problem is I have a 5-year-old iMac, Intel iMac, the white plastic job. It was running OS Tiger.
You mean the desktop, or the or do you mean the laptop?
20-inch desktop.
Okay.
It's an iMac, not a MacBook.
Yeah, got it.
And 2 weeks ago, it just up and died on me. I got the kernel panic message.
Right.
And I've been to the Apple Store Genius Bar, and they originally thought it might be the hard drive, so they attempted to replace the hard drive. That did not fix the problem.
Really? Well, that would have been my guess. Yeah.
So now they're saying that the situation is the logic board.
Right.
That's $900+.
Not worth it. Don't even go there. 5-year-old iMac for $900. Forget it. $1,200, you get a brand new one. By the way, Apple has already announced that their new operating system, which comes out late this summer, Mountain Lion, is not going to run on that old Mac. It's not going to, in fact, run on any Mac older than a few years old. So if you want to stay up to date, I would say it's time to say goodbye to that old iMac. I hate to do it. I mean, I really do. But there's something seriously wrong. If your computer is 5 years old, Mac or Windows, and it's still running, it's not time to, you know, send it out to pasture. But if it's broken, it's certainly not worth fixing a computer of that vintage. It's just too expensive. And you can get a brand new iMac, more powerful, nicer, for just a couple $100 more than just that logic board. That's what I would do. Hey, guess what? Dick DiBartolo, Mad Magazine's maddest writer, and our gadget hound is coming up with a gadget of the week right after these messages at 47 after the hour. You stay right here. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Dick DiBartolo is our gadget guy, Mad Magazine's maddest writer. He joins us every week to deliver unto us a fine gadget. Hello, Dickie D.
Leo, how you doing?
I well. How are you? I well. Are you well? I well.
Me well.
Good.
You well, too. Good. No, I have something that has your name on it.
Oh, well, can I have it back? Oh, all right.
And at the show, they said, why are you writing that man's name on that? You haven't bought that. But this is so you. So you. You didn't ever buy a Segway, right?
I never did, although I'm tempted now. I think that they're probably not very expensive.
Oh, well,
ever since the president of Segway drove one off a cliff to his death. That's really kind of slows the market down when those things happen.
Yeah, well, no one's done that yet. You could be the first to do that with solo wheels.
Oh, you know, I want one of these. This is like a unicycle Segway.
Yes, this is all this is a wheel. Okay. Yeah,
it's just a wheel.
A wheel with a gyroscope and a battery and no handle, no buttons. You step on it, lean forward, and you're on your way. I get so emotional when I talk to you. Now, you can go up to 10 miles an hour. You can go 10 to 20 miles is the range on one battery charge. This is, what do you, how far from your house to the studio?
1 mile.
Oh,
so
my
I
God.
I charge this once every 3 weeks.
There you go.
Yeah.
And you have pretty good balance?
No.
I think.
I somebody said in the chat room when you showed this that this was a face plant waiting to happen. I mean, I don't. Does it. Now, have you tried it?
You know what? They asked me. It was at Toy Fair for some bizarre reason because.
Well, it's a toy.
It says right on the brochure, not for people under 15.
Not a toy.
This toy is the toy show, but it's not a toy.
Do not play and with a solo wheel.
No, I did not. I said I preferred leaving in a cab, not an ambulance.
Or a cast. Now, they say it's self-balancing. But I don't notice it ever just standing alone by itself. I mean, it seems like there's always somebody on it.
No, you do need, it does need you to balance it. But when you get to your destination, the good thing is, like in New York City, you get to your destination, you fold the two pedals up that you're standing on, you carry it into the office. It does weigh 26 pounds.
Ooh, it's heavy.
It is heavy, but...
But that's probably mostly battery. So if imagine, if you will, folks, it's a wheel with you know, kind of like a foot rests on either side and a handle on the top so you can carry it like a briefcase. It's, what, about a foot and a half, 18 inches? And
in diameter, yes. Yeah. But when you're riding it, you are just balanced on it. There's no handles.
There's nothing. And you, what do you lean forward to go forward? And
lean forward to go forward. Stand up to go to stop it. And if you go to their website, solowheel.com, you know, you have people. They probably work for the company and practice 10 hours a day.
I'm really tempted. I would like this.
You know what? It's the kind of thing that you probably would be good at, or you would throw it out the window. There's no in between.
Or I would throw me out the window.
Yes.
That would be the other option.
Now, wait a minute. Price.
Yeah, how much? Because what was the Segway? It was like $5,000, right?
Oh, okay. Well, this beats the Segway. This is $1,795.
Well, that's nothing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So
well, you know, you could if you want the Segway, you could just buy two of these, put a plank in between. Pretty much the same thing.
You know, after people saw the movie Back to the Future and they saw Marty McFly on a hoverboard, I think that there's just been an interest in this kind of a thing that you would just kind of float along. Now, it's not hovering, it's pretty. Now, what's the top speed on this?
10 miles an hour.
That's enough to really hurt yourself.
Yeah, well, yeah. And the range is nice. And, you know, like hybrid cars, braking and downhill helps generate electricity to put it back into the battery. So that could help increase the range.
Sure. I'm not sure I'd want to ride this downhill, Dick.
I would not go down a steep hill.
Does it have brakes?
No, you are the brake.
Yeah, brake you.
Or you can brake something.
Yeah. Yes. It's an intriguing idea, I have to say.
They did ask me to try it, and I said I wanted to leave in a cab, not an ambulance, I didn't try it.
I'm tempted. If they'll tell you what, if they will lend me one, I'm not going to buy this, but if they would lend me one, I would attempt to ride it down the streets of Petaluma.
I will. I have the lady's card.
Just tell her. The Butter and Eggs Day parade's coming up next month.
Oh, this has butter and eggs written all over it. And once you crash into that fruit stand, it really...
I'll have butter and eggs all over me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Solowheel.com. Interesting idea. Now, Dick does a podcast on this show. In fact, we're going to record it right after the radio show called The Weekly Daily Gizwiz, in which he gives us a number of gadgets somewhat like this. Not all of them life-threatening. He also has a website where you could find all of his gadget picks and reviews. It's gizwiz.biz.
Yes, and this is pretty much the last chance to play the January-February game.
I know people want to win that autographed copy of Mad Magazine. So if you go there, gizwiz.biz, and you click the button that says, what the heck is it? You'll see this picture of duck pins. I don't know what it is. But here's the deal. 12 autographed mads for the right answer, 24 for the wrong answer. So I think you have a good shot.
Yeah, we like wrong.
Yeah, and it's
we
got,
like silly and cute.
It's That's got Mike and Molly, the new Mad that just I just saw it in the stores. The April Mad just showed up in the stores today.
Yes,
Mike
sir.
And Molly on the cover. Gizwiz.biz. Thank you, Dickie D.
Thank you, sir. See you in a bit.
See you in a bit. Stick around. Don't go anywhere. Because we are going to do the weekly daily Gizwiz in a momento. You know, I don't have enough time to get another call in. I am so sorry. I tell you what, if you're on the line, I got Mark, who's in Australia, wants to call. I got Monk in Boise. I got Dennis in Downey. Can we just agree to meet here again tomorrow and do this some more? And, of course, all week long on my podcast network, TWIT.TV, we talk obsessively and endlessly about technology. If that's not appealing to you, this is not the network for you. But if you are interested in endless obsessive conversation about every facet of technology, TWIT.TV all week long. We also have audio versions of this show and video as well, including all the show notes available at the Tech Guy site. It's techguylabs.com. Thanks to James DeRuvo for writing everything down. You'll find links to the show and the chat room and the video and all that. And all the people we've mentioned, too, at techguylabs.com. I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Have a great Geek Week. Wah, 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 wah.